This talk was given by Vanessa Zuise Goddard Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Zuise Sensei is a lay teacher in the Mountains and Rivers Order and the work supervisor at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
This is Kabir. Be silent in your mind, silent in your senses, and also silent in your body. Then when all these are silent, don't do anything. In that state, truth will reveal itself to you. It will appear in front of you and ask, "What do you want?" So this afternoon, I wanted to return to this, you could say, this paradox, this conundrum of silence being such a natural state of being for us, and also it requiring deliberate care and practice. And the question is, how do you do that? How do you truly practice silence? How do you practice being silent, being that silence, as I said earlier today? And, you know, I think probably we would all agree that it's not just a matter of not speaking, right? That there's something else that needs to happen. And silence, you know, when you're actively turned toward it, it's a presence. Right, it's filled with something, whether it sounds, if it's like natural sounds, or it has a feeling tone. He's a therapist and psychotherapist and philosopher, Paul Goodman, described different kinds of silence. He says, not speaking and speaking are both human ways of being in the world, and there are kinds and grades of each. There is the dumb silence of slumber or apathy, the sober silence that goes with a solemn animal face, the fertile silence of awareness pasturing the soul, from which emerge new thoughts, the alive silence of alert perception ready to say this, this, the musical silence that accompanies absorbed activity, the silence of listening to another speak, catching the drift and helping them be clear, the noisy silence of resentment and self-recrimination, loud and sub-vocal speech but sullen to say it, baffled silence, and the silence of peaceful accord with other persons or communions or communion with the cosmos. And that one, the noisy silence of resentment and self-recrimination, loud and sub-vocal speech but sullen to say it. I really like how he phrased that. You know, you are filled with some kind of feeling. You had an interaction with someone and it didn't go well. And you're filled with your feelings about it and perhaps resentment and either self-recrimination or other recrimination, but you can't say it, right? And yet every bit of your being is communicating it. And if we're awake enough, we feel it. We feel it in ourselves. We feel it in another. All those things that they are not saying about how they feel about us in that moment, what just happened. Right? And, you know, we live in community. We live in close quarters. We live close together. And so things happen. You know, conflict explodes, even though we are here to help one another. Wake up, as I often say, we misunderstand each other, we disagree with one another, and yet so often we find it very difficult to communicate in a clear and direct way. This is what happened. You said this, and it hurt me. I feel hurt now, and so instead, it just kind of seeps out. You know, through our actions, our thoughts get kind of sometimes splattered. And I say that because sometimes it's a kind of violent way in which we have to turn our resentment and recrimination outward so we don't have to feel it. Right? And so silence, Thich Nhat Hanh would speak quite a bit about this, about relationships and communicating. And he would always stress the importance of silence to create a space in which you can really take in the other and to the best of your ability, communicate yourself to them. And of course, you know, we know there's things like nonviolent communication. I mean, there's a whole study of how to communicate with one another. But I wonder how much more facile we would be with it if we were more versed in silence. Right? How many times have you caught yourself, someone is saying something to you, and you're already, they haven't even finished speaking, you're already planning your response, you already know what you're going to say to them. How much of what you're saying is really responding to them and their words, how much of it is your idea of them and their words, what you think they're meaning, what you think they're feeling, what you think they're trying to say. Is it really what they're trying to say, or is it what you think, right, they're saying? And so how much of our communication just misses? You know, we miss one another. And so I've been thinking of silence. You know, in Buddhism, we speak. We have terms. We speak of the absolute, right? We speak of emptiness. Thich Nhat Hanh calls it interbeing, which I have always liked because it, instead of feeling like a void, like there is nothing, I'm going to disappear, you realize that when the self drops, what you realize is you are everything. You are, in fact, in a constant state of interbeing. So I've always liked that word, and it feels full of life and full of possibility. So silence is not a synonym for these, but as I said earlier, to me it's a very, very powerful entry point into an understanding that when I'm you and I are speaking and we're having a disagreement, that it's fine. I don't actually have to agree with you. We don't have to think alike in order to get along. But that if I understand that you and I are in fact fundamentally the same thing, I may be just a little bit at least more willing to try to meet you, to try to understand you. This is what I want to talk about tomorrow. How do we really meet another? And without some degree of silence, that becomes very difficult. Because then it's a layer upon layer upon layer of projection in our ideas and our opinions. And so the Buddha spoke of noble silence, and he often would encourage his monks to practice noble silence. And so one day, one of his primary disciples, Moggallana, is thinking about this. He's on his own, and he's reflecting on this. And he says to himself, as I was thinking, as I was withdrawn in seclusion, right? So he is perhaps sitting, and he's thinking of this term, noble silence. He says, you know, we so often say noble silence, but really, what is this? And he reflects on it some more, and then he says, the thought occurred to me. There is a case where a practitioner, with a stilling of directed thought and evaluation, enters and remains in the second jhana, rapture and happiness born of concentration, unification of awareness free from directed thought and evaluation, internal assurance. This is called noble silence. And mark that term, internal assurance. Right? It's a moment of knowing, of a kind of confidence. I often speak of it as you're standing on your own ground. You understand in a moment, this is me, this is my mind, this is a thought, this is an object. And even in the moment in which they merge, because nobody stays there, you come out of that state and you understand. That is an internal assurance. Elsewhere, the Buddha called it clear comprehension. And so, you know, the jhanas, and I touched on them earlier, there were these deep states of concentration, which it is said the Buddha moved through very methodically on his way to enlightenment, to realization. And he describes them very, very deliberately and with a simile each. And we don't really study them directly in Zen. We certainly don't cultivate them, because in Vipassana, you're actually taught how to cultivate each one of these states, how to move from one to the other, how to identify, is this the first jhana, is this the second jhana, right? So they do a very systematic study of these. We don't. And yet, I have found it deeply helpful. Because when I read these, I all of a sudden had a framework from what I was experiencing in Zazen. Right, so we work with the breath, we work with shikantaza, as I said earlier, we work with koans, some of us, where you're holding a question with your being, and you're allowing your mind to remain steady on that question, so that it's not moving, you're not trying to figure it out. And so you have to hold it with your whole being, and at the same time, as I said earlier, you know, things will be happening, thoughts will be occurring to you, you know, feelings will be appearing, and yet there is this question that you are working with. And so, and yet, what is described in the sutras, this the application of directed thought, as I was saying earlier to CJ, is in fact that process of seeing a thought, letting it go, and coming back. The arising of rapture is that good feeling, that feeling of, oh, I don't want this to end. And so, and it goes on to describe equanimity, that feeling of balance, of seeing it. I often experience it as everything is right, just as it is. Doesn't mean that there aren't problems in the world or problems in my life, but everything is right. It's a state of rightness, right? That is very palpable, I find, in the silence of Zazen. And so, you know, so just briefly, in the first jhana, you are affecting, you're deliberately concentrating, and you're directing your thought and evaluation, which is interesting. So here, you do need to be able to know, am I actually practicing? Am I letting go of thoughts? Or am I just kind of pushing them aside? Am I really concentrating? Or am I just sitting there really just thinking, following my stories, right? So there is an element of knowing what is happening in your practice in the first jhana. And it says, you know, the simile is that it's like someone who's taking a bath and, you know, it's making a ball. So you have powdered soap and they're making a ball with it. So you're wetting this soap and making a ball. And so it's deliberate, like you're wetting and kneading and wetting and kneading it and until the water is suffusing the ball. But there's effort, right? There's active, it's engaged, you are in relationship with it. In the second jhana, now there's less effort. There's a unification of awareness free from directed thought and evaluation. So it's the moment we you stop measuring. Am I practicing? Am I there yet? Am I enlightened yet? You know, you're no longer concerned. You trust your own effort. You trust your capacity. And you let it, you let your mind do what it will do. So you're not thinking about the breath. You're not even necessarily trying to concentrate. It's more like what teachers describe as resting in that natural, bright, luminous state of mind. Which sounds, in one way, so good, and in another sense, frustrating. You know, when you read it, the first time I would read these Tibetan teachers, and they would say, well, don't concentrate, don't let go, don't analyze, don't recall, just rest in a natural, bright state of mind. Well, how? How do you do that? Right? I kind of sense that this is my natural state of being, but why doesn't it feel that way most of the time? Right, so I would find a certain degree of frustration. At the same time, I would understand what they were saying is, yes, is get out of your own way and allow that to happen. And the simile that they give for this jhana is that it's like a river that is flowing naturally in one direction. Right? If there's no obstacle in this path, in its path, the water just flows. And it flows into this lake without outflow. And the water, when it arrives at this body of water, it does what water does naturally when it has no other place to go. It rises. And the lake slowly fills with cool water. And it's rising without impediment. And so here you get the sense, now the effort has shifted from this very dedicated, pointed effort to a kind of effortlessness, which kind of points back to the question that I was asking all of you earlier. You know, how does this work? If it's a natural state, why do we have to work so hard to get there, you know, to attain it? And so the jhanas are kind of, they're showing you how this actually works. And then with each one, so progressively, you let go of the rapture and the happiness. You don't even let go of it. It dissolves. Until there's, in the fourth jhana, there is no separation whatsoever. Subject and object have become one. You are the breath. As I often say to people, if they're working on the breath, it is no longer you sitting on that line working on being the breath or following the breath. It's the breath that is sitting on line. It's the breath that is coming into this room. It's the breath that is bowing. And there is such a state. And you cannot create it. And at the same time, you can't just wait for it to happen. That's the tension. That's the tension, really, of any aspect of the spiritual path. And to me, also, what the description of these jhanas points to is that this isn't an accidental state, right? So this isn't just a kind of bolt of lightning that happens when you're in luck. When your zazen is going well and all of a sudden things spontaneously quiet down. You are very deliberately cultivating this. And so there is, again, that side of it where you do have to buckle down, you know, and exert effort. And at a certain point, you let go and allow the mind to be. And all of it, as I said earlier, leads to single-minded concentration for the cultivation of wisdom. And so Moggallana is basically saying that silence, noble silence, is that concentration, is that undivided awareness. So it's not just the stilling of thoughts. It is that moment in which subject and object become one, that is really true silence. So those of you, you know, who do sesshin regularly and you hear the sesshin precautions, when you hear that precaution of maintaining silence, remember this. Try to listen to it through that filter. It's not just don't speak, don't talk to yourself, don't speak to somebody else. Think of it as encouraging you to cultivate that single-minded concentration. And so until you get to that place, you know, there are still thoughts, and as I said earlier, and there are feelings. And yet, what degree of silence do you need in order to practice silence itself? So when people say, you know, sometimes it's really loud actually at the monastery. There's people walking around, there's the kyosaku, there's the bells ringing. You know, it's actually, I find it really hard to concentrate. People will often say, at home I'm doing fine, but here there's just so much happening. How do you practice that? Because it's actually a very common complaint or, you know, just thing that comes up. Sometimes people say, I'm doing really well in my practice at home, and I come to the monastery, it's a free-for-all. So how do you practice that? And, Mike?
I treat it like an itch or
yellow.
I treat it like an itch or a pain. I try to go into the heart of it instead of pushing against it or trying to shut it out. I try to go to the center of it, and then it just dissipates, it disappears.
So, how do you do that? So let's say there's somebody sitting next to you. Excuse me. There's somebody sitting next to you who's breathing really loudly, for example. You said you go to the heart of it. How? How do you do that?
Well, I first notice myself noticing it. And, you know, maybe my initial reaction is, oh, loud breath. I wish it were quieter,
right? Which is most people's initial reaction.
And then the way I would do with an itch, I let that loud breathing become everything. I just enter it.
Yes, okay. Anybody else? Liz?
I actually treat it a bit like the exercise that we did outside, which is the, I'm trying to like listen outwards or feel outwards and let all the sounds come in at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So the crackle of the heater in the Zendo is actually really no different from the wind in the pine trees. For me, it really, the sounds all are just as relaxing as being outside. Because I'm sort of open to them,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not trying to, you know, push them away or ignore them. I'm actually really open to them.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what the sound is.
The only thing I still have problem with is if people have a watch and it's mm-hmm. ticking, because then I feel the regularity of it in some way is much. I start counting the time,
uh-huh.
but that's the only thing that really feels wrong.
Have you ever sat at the temple in Brooklyn?
Yes, and heard all the sounds next door.
Have you heard the drumming
yes.
class next door?
Yes.
I love it. On Thursday, they have this drumming class next door. I love it. And I remember thinking, okay, this we're going on this train. So let me actually ride this beat. You know, and I actually quite literally imagine myself on a boat riding the beat of the drum. I also really like drumming, you know, so it helped. But I wasn't going to try to do something other. I brought it in to my zazen. It's a very enjoyable period of zazen, I have to say. But there's sounds and there's sounds, right? And so there's the wailing of a siren. There's, you know, perhaps a child, you know, screaming next door. And so how do you know, do all sounds get folded in or not?
Most of them do. Some of them take longer. Like if it's not the continuous sounds or things that happen fairly regularly, like even if someone's heavy breathing, it's a regular thing. So it just becomes like a heartbeat almost. Whereas like you say, if there's a siren outside, like in the temple in Brooklyn, then it's a little harder, but I think in the beginning I was quite actively thinking I'm not going to let it be disruptive and mm-hmm. trying to. Hogan gave a talk about generosity,
mm-hmm.
so I tried to actively think about being generous to the things that were like irritating me or previously irritating me, and it really helped to like push. Like generosity out and in with the sound so that it wasn't a bad thing.
Yeah.
Because I was judging it before.
Yeah. Ajahn Chah, who was a very renowned and loved teacher in the Burmese teacher in the Thai forest tradition, once one of his monks once said to him, and I don't know what the noise was, but they were meditating. I think they were doing construction work near their monastery. And one of the monks went to him complaining and said, you know, the noise is bothering me. And Ajahn Chah said, the noise isn't bothering you. You are bothering the noise. How do you practice not bothering the noise, which is, you know, what you've both answered. What else? Yes, Greg.
You go ahead, I don't really do it.
No, it's okay.
So this became very real for me last session. There was someone who was breathing very loudly. And a little backstory for me, my father was a very loud breather, and it drove me crazy. Every time in the same room, I became so irritable, and I grew so bitter, and I knew it had stuff, you know, something to do with other things, but I couldn't stand it. And during Sesshin, I realized that I was going to be sitting with this, and there was nowhere to run, because all the times before with my father, I would.
Mm-hmm.
I would react, I would run away or go away. So after a day or two, when my mind kind of gave up trying to fight what was going on, I asked myself, so what happens if I just let it be? What happens if I don't try to fight the noise and my irritability? And because my mind was going to places like, whoa, what could I do about it?
Mm-hmm.
I was finally able to just sit with my irritability. It was kind of a neat experience. I got to know what it was like for Greg to be irritable. Not to say that that irritability just went away like magic, but I found that my irritability allowed me to experience my past with my father. The different times that we've been together, my irritability with him. It also allowed, I guess, my irritability to become softer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to articulate it, but it wasn't as sharp. It wasn't as painful.
Mm-hmm.
It was still there, but it was subdued, I suppose. And I suppose, for me, I'm continually trying to remind myself that there is nothing inherent in that breath or in that person breathing that is irritable. It's my perception of it that is creating that. And so it helps. But in the end, the only answer for me is practice. So I got to continue.
And what you said about being softer, you know, within it. You know, so as I was saying earlier, and some of it I think is just a style of practice. Some of it is, you know, our karma, and some of it is our understanding or misunderstanding. You know, that, and for some people this is very real. For whom the silence and the stillness, for example, it's actually they experience it as very punitive. You know, for them, silence has been a way of being shut out, a way of not being allowed, you know, to speak, not have a voice. And so there are people for whom Zazen is not the best practice, you know, for whom it is actually very difficult, and for whom the silence feels severe and certainly feels imposed upon. And so, you know, I've been kind of working in my own practice, because I actually very much enjoy silence, but I've been really looking at Pema Chodron uses the phrase, how to stay in your soft spot. And I've just been thinking about that, you know, how to let the edges, if you will, of that silence, or even the container of stillness, remain soft. Right, not just in my zazen, which is important, but then when I get off the cushion, and as I was referring to earlier, if I have an interaction with someone, perhaps I have someone coming at me, and I feel, you know, that need to protect, to defend myself. In that moment, can I rest in a silence that is soft, that allows for the other person, in a sense, to come in to my territory, which before always felt incredibly threatening to me. I did not want that. And now I think, well, I actually do want that. I don't want to protect myself. How can I allow this person in? As I said, I don't have to agree with them necessarily, but how can I remain in that space a little bit longer? So I'm just, you could say, I'm kind of playing, experimenting with the quality of my silence, of my stillness in Zazen and out of it. Yes, Chris.
Okay. This is, touches on something that I was thinking about in the morning session, and I was thinking about someone we know together who was in residency a couple of years ago, a young woman from Brooklyn, who she said the hardest time in her residency was, I don't think this is divulging anything secret, was Bodhidharma session, and we were talking about it. And,
can you explain what that is for people who don't?
Oh, it's the February session during which there's no talks and I think fewer visits from the Kiyosaku. So there's like...
a lot more silence.
A lot more silence even than ordinary session on purpose. And she said, you know, it was like hellacious for her. And I was like, oh yeah, I kind of get that. But she actually talked about how at other times sitting here, she had the experience of, in the silence, her mind would start to worry about things that would happen. She was like, she brought up like one day, like, you know, we don't have a plan if there's like an active shooter scenario here. And I was like,
yeah.
It never crossed my mind. Never. Like, you know, of course it never crosses anyone's mind, which is, some people would say, like, it needs to cross our mind now because it's 2018 and here we are. Like, it happens everywhere. But she's much younger than me. You know, I grew up as a white man in the suburbs, and my whole life, like, I'm the person in the room who doesn't have to worry. I'm the last person to worry about being suppressed, oppressed, victimized, whatever. She's a young woman of color. You know, her life story is very different. And to me, that started me thinking, and we had a lot of conversations over time about... can we really do zazen until we feel safe? And to me, that word is still just there, and how a lot of what I want to do with my life and going to social work school is about, we need to make like the world safe, because if we're not safe, like where I live in Philadelphia and I see young men of color walking down the street getting stopped by the cops, I think, like, is that guy going to be able to sit zazen the way that I do? Where my biggest worries are like more like theoretical existential hangups.
Right.
You know, his are not theoretical and they're not existential. Well, they're existential and like they're a threat, but like I can't imagine the answer is yes. I can't imagine that person is going to have the same access until they feel safe enough to not be in a zendo or somewhere else and have, you know, the sound of something unknown happening. Triggers a whole different set of fantasies. You know, the mind goes crazy. And mine does too, but mine's like, maybe it's a bear, you know, not maybe it's an active shooter. And I just thought of that this morning about like the flavor of silence. If silence has a flavor that brings up fear for me, and I've known that sometimes in my life, but not that much, and it's pretty rare. But to feel that more often, I'm sure, would really color my practice, would really change it.
Oh, yeah.
And if I don't know that that's what's happening, you know, it may take a while for someone to help me understand, like, oh, like, do you feel safe? And you're like, oh, actually, I don't. And my body's always on some degree of alert, you know? It's just a very live question. I think of, like, the Buddha and his followers, like, sometimes sitting in the woods. You know, and there's stories about, like, watch out for things that slither and things that crawl and things that bite. And it was real in a very different way, like, because there were actually, like, wild tigers. Like, that's a whole other level of, like, you know, I'm just sitting there and, like, is that a wild tiger? But, you know, they faced it too, and some of his followers would be really scared, you know, and they were like, we don't want to go sit in the woods because there's evil spirits and tigers. And that was real for them. So it's just something I think about a lot, like, what is silence for each person with regard to, do we feel like safe at the deepest level?
Yes, and that is why we can't just throw out the stories, because of course each of us brings ourselves, you know, to the silence, to zazen, you know, to that space. So for someone it is a refuge. For me, silence, you know, solitude, stillness has, I think, yeah, always been a refuge. For somebody else, is a shooter going to come in and get me? And it's hard for me to even conceive of that state of mind, right? Because I don't live there. And for somebody else, is their everyday reality. And I am very aware that even when I say, you know, so let go of a thought, it's from a place where I have been allowed to have my thought, to have my story, to express it. There's so many people for whom that is not the case. So this whole idea, even this whole sense of letting go of the self, having had a pretty healthy upbringing with a healthy sense of being affirmed as a human being, I felt, you know, at least somewhat ready to begin to look at the work, to do the work of letting go of the self. But what if my upbringing was not that? What if I was always negated, denied my existence, my the validity of my expression? And now I come here and I'm being told, well, now let go of yourself. Well, maybe not. You know, so even now as we're speaking and as I'm saying these words, I understand that you know, people will experience, each of us will experience them differently. That's why it's so challenging. You know, because I do feel there is a teaching that has a truth in it. Otherwise, you know, Buddhism wouldn't have lasted 2,500 years. So something is true and it's working. And the Buddha was speaking of suffering that is universal. But because of our karma, of our history, each of us will have experienced different kinds of suffering. And that's when it gets trickier. And that's why I was saying it in a slightly different, from a slightly different angle. But that's another reason why I feel it's really important to find your own practice, to find your own entry point, to really question, reflect, you know, when you hear a teaching, to take it in and not just interpret it according to your view, because your view may be not exactly right, but to really take it in and reflect and think to yourself, as the Buddha himself encouraged us to do, he basically said in so many words, I'm just telling you what I experience. Don't believe me. Go out and, you know, you try it and see, does this work in your life? Is it relevant? Is it actually helping you to live your life in a freer way? And if it isn't, okay, then you need to reflect, you need to reconsider. Maybe there's something else, you know, going on. So I think that's really, really important. You know, as a woman, my experience of practice is different than it is for a man. A younger, older, race, ability, you know, all of it, of course, will absolutely color, shape our experience. Yeah. Yes, Mayosa.
I'm not sure I can articulate this, but something is coming up about silence. We're talking about silence and sounds, like external sounds, or thoughts. And I'm thinking about liturgy, for me, is, mm-hmm. You know, all the chanting and bells. Like, for me, it's like stepping into a hot bath. It's just like, you know, I was raised Catholic. I'm no longer practicing Catholic, but part of what I find really comforting and safe in this practice is liturgy. And maybe it's a childhood thing, I don't know, but it feels very safe. And in a way, it's an experience of silence, but more in the sense of, in Spanish, quietud, quieto. Mm-hmm. So it's like quiet, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily about sound, because obviously there's a lot going on. There's a lot of noise in liturgy and chanting. And I'm wondering, in a way, because I'm so present with the sound or making sound with my voice in a way that stills everything, mm-hmm. like my thoughts, my most of the time, not every time, but that's very much in a paradoxical way my experience of silence sometimes. And I'm beginning to question it, because obviously it can be a crutch, I guess, or I'm not sure what I'm trying to
It could, get at. But if it's not broken, don't fix it.
No, it's not broken, but I'm thinking of, okay, well, it does create attachment, because then when I'm sitting and all these thoughts come, sometimes, you know, it's I guess I'm like seeking and wanting this very pleasurable experience that, you know, I guess it's like a full body mind experience for me that I don't have in other aspects of practice.
Yeah. Well, we can attach to anything if we want to. You know, pretty much we can attach to realization. You know, we can attach to emptiness, although that seems impossible. You know, actually, people actually do. In a sense of that, it's not emptiness per se, because you can't really attach to emptiness, but it's attaching to that feeling, to that quiet, to that solitude, to that, you know, in emptiness, there is no conflict. It's a pretty nice place to be. And so many of the koans are actually warning practitioners against that. So you can really attach to anything. But I think it's there's nothing wrong with having that feeling of pleasure. You know, if zazen was just a drag, how many of us would do it? You know, I guess maybe there are people who do. You're about to raise your hand. Do you really, is it a drag? Oh, okay, I take that back.
No, I'm not contradicting what you're saying. It's more about, I guess the conflict that's coming up right now for me is how I just check out when, you know, even from unpleasant sounds, like we're talking about people breathing loud or banging noises or traffic, and it's not that they don't bother me, it's just that I'm somewhere else.
Oh, I see. So you're saying the same thing is happening in liturgy?
No.
So then what's the problem?
I don't know.
So let me see if I...
I guess there's no problem.
Well, so far what you're describing... I mean, I think what you're saying is you're concerned that you might be attaching to your experience of liturgy, because it is a pleasurable experience for you, and it seems to be meaningful experience, right? And so I think, you know, what I was trying to say is that that's wonderful, you know, that, and you know, part of the reason we have 8 gates of training is because each of us will tend towards certain things. You know, as I said earlier, some of you find it easier to do zazen when you're moving. Some of us find it easier to be still. Some of us really are drawn to art practice. Some of us are more physical. And so that's the beauty of it, that you really can enter in all these different ways. And so, yes, there are these ways in which we can turn it into something else. The Buddha calls it the I-making, the me-making mind, which, and he actually speaks of it. There's a monk who's speaking to him, saying he's experienced the jhanas, and the monk says, but I actually didn't think to myself, oh, I just entered the first jhana. I didn't think to myself, oh, I just entered the second jhana. And the Buddha says, you didn't think that because the I-making and me-making mind was not active. In other words, he didn't make it about himself. He was just meditating. You can just be chanting. You know, the moment where it's like, oh, that was a great service, I love that chanting. Okay, you just see that. There's the I making itself in that moment. It's like, oh, there I go again. You set it aside and you bring yourself back. I mean, I have all these... you could say kind of mini liturgies that I do for exactly that purpose. All the ways in which I recreate myself, you know, before I do this, you know, before I give a talk, sometimes during, sometimes often after. This isn't about me. Let it go. Release. For some people, it's actually the practice is the opposite. Own this. Really step into it. And that's why it's important to know yourself, what is the skillful means for you? And if you like liturgy, turn to it, because it will teach you. For somebody else, they struggle. It's like, oh my God, I hate the liturgy, but I have to do it when I go to the monastery. So they have to get through that obstacle. You don't. Wonderful. Use it. And let it actually teach you, because it will. If you let it, it will.
I guess it's just sort of a wanting to disappear or coalesce or whatever the word might be in the same way in other aspects of practice.
And can you repeat how you said you work with a sound, with an the breath, you know, when somebody's breathing loudly? Would you mind just giving her the mic? Can you repeat how you said you work with that?
So I have an initial reaction. I notice that I'm noticing it.
I-making? Me-making?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I treat it like an itch just let it become everything. I just
right there. Enter it. Let it become everything. That is how you disappear. Dido used to say, you know, there's no self, it's all self. And he didn't mean, you know, it's all about me. He meant, let it encompass everything. Let that chanting be the whole universe. Then you wouldn't even have to worry, am I attaching, am I not attaching? There'll be no room for that. Yes, Kristen. Hold on, they'll pass you a mic.
So when you just said, let it be everything, let it become everything, I think about chronic pain that way too. Mm-hmm. So there's sort of pain that you can work with in a different way where you aren't, I don't want to say focusing on it, but you sort of allow it to be, move on, like another thought, yes, there's my knee hurting or there's my back hurting.
Right.
But then there's chronic pain, and working with that is very similar to what she just described. I'm sorry, I forget her name, but
the idea
of it being becoming everything.
Yeah.
It's a real challenge.
And so just to refine that a little bit, and that's a very good example because pain is so uncomfortable. It's so painful, especially if it's intense pain, or if you know if it's chronic and you know this is, here it is again. And I'm sure there's, you know, the resistance that comes up and the, perhaps anger, you know, tiredness. And so there it is, the moment of pain. How do you let that become everything?
I wish that I was better at it, but it's something that it's the reason I came to this practice so many years ago. So for me, it's definitely a life, I don't want to say a life or death thing, but it's definitely a quality of life issue. So working with sound is way easier for me because
yes.
That is not, it's like a distraction that I can handle. It's a distraction that, or it's an experience that I feel better prepared because of my pain. So that is way more, you know, do you know what I mean? It's
yes.
Way more difficult to deal with that
right.
than a crying baby or a barking dog or a loud breather. And so when somebody said, I think it was Chris, said that everybody brings their own experiences to this practice. Some of us, it's like really difficult to sit for long periods or to not be consumed by pain, physical yeah. or emotional. In my case, it's always been physical. So working with sound, it's almost like a practice for, it's always been like a preparation for me to, not a prep, like a, yeah, like a practice, like an exercise almost, to be able to deal with other things that are more difficult, like chronic pain.
Yeah. And yet you said something that I think is a key element of it. And it's basically when you don't have a choice. You said something like you have to. Oh, so you said it's a matter of life and death, right? Or something
quality
or
of life.
Quality
yeah.
of life. So when you have to. Right, and so you do everything that you can to find a way, and so that is also, you know, so much of what happens. You know, you think of the stillness and all of that space in your mind and in zazen, and how many times you just move away, you just turn, you just kind of wiggle out because you have that option, and then every once in a while there'll be that thing, whether it's physical pain or a memory that comes or something happens, somebody close to you dies. There's no way that you can talk yourself out of that. You could numb yourself, but if you're sitting zazen, you're trying to do something else. And so when you don't have a choice, there's a little bit of an advantage. It's not that, you know, you would wish that on anyone, but if you have to, you'll find a way. You know, so that's, it's kind of the bittersweetness, the razor's edge of pain is, you know, as I was saying to some of you last night, that as sentient beings, we will inevitably feel pain. There is really no way to avoid it, but it's how we relate to it that creates or not the suffering. And so in a moment where pain is fully present is to train yourself to more and more be able to hold it and to hold it softly, which is the most challenging thing. you know, how to soften into that pain. You know, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who works, of course, with, has been doing so for years with people with chronic pain, asks a very interesting question. He says, does my awareness of pain, is my awareness of pain in pain? Next time, you know, you have pain in your knee, pain in your back, you know, whatever moment of, it'll be a little bit easier if you work with it with physical pain first. Really, really kind of center yourself in that sensation in that moment and ask yourself, right now, is the awareness of pain in pain? Anybody else? Yes, can say. I don't think that's working.
Is it on?
Oh, check at the bottom, yeah.
So in the Zendo I sit in back home, there's a lot of trucks that go past, and so it's often noisy, and sometimes it's quiet. And I just noticed a bit with that sort of noise and with like the noise of a lawnmower or something outside. Like I'm sitting and I'm not even necessarily very conscious of the noise anymore. I just, you know, think I'm practicing at some level. And then the noise stops and I realize that I've been, and I sort of go quiet myself internally, and I realize that I've been holding my thoughts as a sort of like barrier to that thing. And I just wondered, I'm sort of wondering if you know, what control or what, you know, do I need to do that now? It's sort of, but it's happened a lot, so it's just something.
Well, that's a very good question. Do you need to do that?
I don't know.
You have done it, it sounds, you know, so far you say I've done it a lot. But it's a good question to ask. Do I need to do that? Do I still need to do that? Do I need to protect myself from that sound? Do I need to brace against that noise? I think, unfortunately, for many of us, especially if we living in the city, we're constantly braced against that, against the assault, constant assault of noise. And so I think some of us just learn that, you know, very, very naturally. But if you can begin to create a little bit of space, let that space hold that question, do I need to brace myself against this, or is there another way that I could perhaps relate to this noise of these trucks passing by? Yeah, let it be a question, in other words. Yes, Janet.
This is a white mic. Non-judgment, patience, tolerance, this is the material of you know, what I'd rather not practice. for me, the thoughts that come, or the feelings that come, or the noises that come, or the pain that comes, is the thing itself, and that presents as something in my awareness. But the harder, the bigger reaction is always being annoyed at myself for judging it, like the awareness that something comes to me and my response is to brace against it or push it away or scold myself for having this. So I just wonder if you would speak to us about compassion for the self in silence and non-judgment.
This isn't exactly that, but it made me think, as you were speaking, of this story that one of the monastics shared with me recently. She's been doing an online course on race studies, and the woman who was presenting had a set of slides, and I don't remember exactly what they were, but there were two charts with, you know, maybe 10 or so, 20 bullet points each. And my friend and actually a couple of other people immediately noticed that the bullet points, that the type was different sizes. And my friend's immediate feeling was one of distrust, actually. It was like, is this woman qualified, you know, to be teaching this course? I don't know, you know, we spent this money, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. And later when she talked to someone else who's also a student of the monastery, was also taking the course, he had the same reaction. You know, she didn't notice it. I mean, feeling kind of like, this is so unprofessional, right? So they both had that instant judgment, in this case, not towards themselves, but towards someone else. And the presenter went through her presentation, went through the slides, and then she said, by the way, you may have noticed that these slides, that the charts are, the font is different size. I did that on purpose. She says, I'm working with my perfectionism. So that is my way of disrupting. She didn't say this, but this is her way of disrupting her I-making, me-making construct, you know. I thought that was such a beautiful, I mean, such a simple thing. So clearly not so simple, because people immediately reacted to it. They created a story about it. And she was basically saying, this is how I undermine. She said further, this is how I undermine white supremacy. But from the perspective of perfectionism, her perfectionism, she says, let's shake it up. Basically, let's not buy into that story anymore. So that's one way, you know, to work with yourself. The moment that it arises, it's already there. Oh, there's the judgment. There, I can't believe I'm doing this again. One of the practices that I use the most and that I like to offer the most is the Four Immeasurables. And the Four Immeasurables go all the way back to the Buddha, and they're both a practice of metta, of loving kindness, but they're also presented as a meditation object. So in the Path of Purification, Buddhaghosa speaks of them as that is actually the object of your concentration instead of the breath, that you use them to cultivate samadhi. And you always begin by offering them to yourself first. And the Four Immeasurables are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, which is joy at others' well-being. It includes your well-being, but especially joy at others' success, others' well-being, and equanimity. And there's many different versions of it, you could say translations. The version that I use is simple, and it's, may I be filled with happiness and know the root of happiness. May I be free of suffering and know the root of suffering. May I never be separated from boundless joy, which is free of suffering. May I remain in perfect equanimity, which knows no desire or aversion. And that one is a little tricky because it makes it sound as don't feel or just be neutral. Equanimity really means if you were riding the wave of anger, ride it and then come back and let your boat rest. If you're in the pit of despair, go there, allow it, and then come back and regain your balance. So it doesn't mean a flat line. It just means, you know, really allow your emotions to be what they are. And so you always, you repeat them to yourself. So you offer them to yourself first. If you want, then you offer them to people that you know and love, because it's easier to do that. Next, you extend it to people that you don't know and probably don't love. You know, it could be people in your country or people in your neighborhood or, you know, whoever or further. And lastly, because it's the most difficult, you offer it to those that you have difficulty with, perhaps those even who have hurt you, because that is the most difficult, most profound, most advanced, you could say, practice. Right, so you always start with yourself. And it's very difficult. I use it primarily if I have a conflict with someone else. So there's that reaction in my mind that I have towards them, perhaps negative. And it's very difficult to be wishing someone well-being and be angry at them at the same time. In fact, it's not quite possible. And so I make it an immediate practice. May you be filled with happiness and know the root of happiness. May you be free of suffering you know, the root of suffering. And sometimes, you know, and the first two, they're very easy to remember. So sometimes I just use those two. So that is one way I have found a very powerful way. In that moment of your judgment coming up, may I be filled with happiness. May I be free of suffering. Okay, so let me talk about the four nutriments that I mentioned earlier. So these are all the things that we take in. Now, we're taking in all the time, right? Without food, we could not eat. Without sense, impressions, we could not live, really. We couldn't interact with reality. Volition is the third, and it's really our desires. It's like, what do we, but not just, not sensual desire, but our intent, our will. What do we actually want to do? Our lives, what do we want our lives to be? And then consciousness, which is of how we process what we take in through the senses, etc. So food, it's, you know, first is very, very practically the kind of food that we are taking in. And of course, more and more we know the effect, because there's been so many studies, there's been so much written about it, that the food that we ingest directly affects our whole being and how we interact with the world. And so, and of course, it literally becomes our body and it becomes what we put out, but it, in every sense, not just in a biological sense. And so being aware, that is one of the reasons why in Buddhism, taking in a meal is such a liturgy, is such an act of mindful attention. You know, to do orioki, for example, is to say that, just to really to acknowledge that you are taking life in order to support your own life, that there's no way to avoid that. There's the kinds of life, of course, that you'll take in, but that you can't avoid that. So the question is, how will you do that? And with what awareness? I mean, the chant that we did earlier, right? It says, you know, does my practice deserve this? And, you know, people sometimes get offended. There's people who've actually gotten offended at that line. To me, I mean, really what it's saying is am I aware of the burden, the responsibility that I have when taking in food and what I put out? You know, it's not to make us feel bad about ourselves. It's basically saying, do you know, one, where this food comes from? Do you know why you're eating it? We say we take it, you know, really to support our life, but to give it, you know, to practice good, to refrain from harm, to practice good, to actualize good for others, the three pure precepts. Right? So the act of eating from our perspective is sacred. It's definitely sacred. And so when you're eating, you know, and you're eating and you're in front of the television, you know, or you're reading the newspaper, that has an effect. That is also what you are taking in. And so to be aware of that is part of the practice. And that is another reason why we do certain meals in silence, because it's just a little easier, you know, than to notice. This morning, even though we didn't do formal, you know, orioki, I just find it so much easier. You know, I'm in line, I'm aware, I'm in line, I'm serving my food, I'm looking at it, I see how much I need in the bowl. Right, it just becomes a little easier to stay present. Sense impressions is everything, right? Everything that we see, everything that we hear, everything that we touch, that we smell, that we taste. And you know, most of us are more visually oriented than not. And so that's the sense that we most rely on, at least consciously. Right, and I was reading, I was actually writing something, a piece about pain, in fact, and I was reading about someone who has an amputated limb, right, and the phantom pain that they feel, and they think that it's due to a kind of neurological tangle, you know, because your brain is still, there's still sensations coming from the end of the limb. But your brain, you know, your eyes are seeing nothing there, and your brain just kind of short circuits and sends an alarm signal, the body's main alarm signal, pain. There's something wrong. And so what they've done is they put, and you may know this, you know, they put somebody, you know, you have them sit on a table, for example, and put their good hand, their good arm down with a mirror, right? And so so you can't really see the good arm, you can only see the reflection. And so it looks to my brain as if I have two. But I have two arms again, two hands, and everything is healthy. And you begin to work. Of course, you just have to describe this. So this is the hand that I don't have, and I just have the one. But now there's the reflection of my left hand. And so by using my good right hand, I'm tricking, in a sense, my brain into thinking that I'm working this hand. And slowly, the pain abates, and in some cases, even disappears. Right, so it's basically visually reminding your brain, yes, there's still something there. You don't need to create this alarm signal. That is how powerful the mind is. I actually had a dream as I was working on this. I had a dream. I've never had it before, never had it since. I knew I was lying on my bed, and I'm not sure how I knew because there was no visual. I just knew that I was home in my bed. And it felt almost as if part of me was awake. And there was no, like I said, no image, no sound. There was, the only thing was the slow, steady pressure of a hand on my throat, just like pressing down. It was terrifying. And part of my brain was just feeling this, and part of my brain was wondering, at which point would I just suffocate, you know, or my vocal cords would just break. And part of it was just focused on the increasing sensation of pain. And I think it was the panic, you know, that in a moment it just jerked me awake. And the moment I was awake, of course, I still had kind of like the after, the reverberations of it, the pain was gone. I even went to check in the mirror. Of course, there was nothing. But the sensation, I had kind of just like the after shadow. I have no idea what it was. Like I said, it never repeated itself. The pain during my sleep was completely real. When I woke up, it was gone. It seems that the mind only needs the you could say, the suggestion of a threat to be present to create that pain. Right? There was nothing, quote unquote, real. And yet, I mean, what is real, right? What is? This feels solid right now. If I was in a dream, it would feel just as solid. And of course, from our perspective, we say, well, all of this is a dream as well. So that's why sense impressions have such a powerful effect on us, because then as they're processed with consciousness. And as they're directed through our will, you know, our volition, it shapes our path, as I said earlier. And so, you know, the thing about will is that we get so many messages, and some of you alluded to this, about who to be, what to want, certainly in our culture. You know, as that painter was saying, you know, someone else's narrative, that it becomes sometimes very difficult to even know what it is that I want. You know, often people will come to a retreat and realize that, for example, they don't actually want to be a banker. I remember one woman who was on Wall Street and came to a sesshin, and she had been doing practice for a while, so it wasn't like it was that instantaneous. But it was in that space, in that silence, the one day she realized, I don't want to do this with my life anymore. This is what I was taught I should be doing. This is what I was told I should want. I don't, in fact, want this. Right? So volition is from the minutest movements, from telling my hand to reach for my water bottle because I want a drink of water, to changing my career, deciding to have a child, and that whole range of my desires, aspirations, of my drives, I'm taking back in as nutriment, is and being nourished or not by it. And then consciousness, which is really what we think. Right, what we think about everything, how we interpret everything that we're experiencing. And so I read, you know, some time ago about an experiment where they were trying to determine, therapists were trying to determine what makes people happy. When do people feel most fulfilled? And so the experiment was that they had a control group, and then they had the experimental group, and I don't remember what size it was, but they gave everybody a beeper. And so you had to go around, you know, just about your day, and the beeper would go off at random times. And then you had a clipboard, and then you had a questionnaire that you had to, in a sense, kind of grade your level of fulfillment in that moment to get kind of a graph of when do people say, what are people doing when they say they're happiest? So perhaps not so surprisingly, one of the highest things on the list was sex, which does make you wonder. I mean, the beeper goes off, and you're like, honey, hold on a second, I have to answer the questionnaire. But apparently people did. And next, people said, oh, and people before the experiment, they asked them, you know, and so people rated sex. And then people said, in my free time, you know, when I have free time, when I'm at home, when I'm resting, when I'm, you know, going for a hike, basically my time off is when I feel most fulfilled. Work was, you know, somewhere down on the list. But then they did the experiment, and the beeper would go off at different times, and then they logged the results. What they found was actually that people are most fulfilled at work because they're being challenged, because they're being engaged. That when people felt most kind of adrift was when they were just sitting at home, quote-unquote resting, right? And so that was such an interesting contrast. There's our assumption, I should feel da-da-da. I should be looking forward to my weekend. This happens so often to the residents here. They're looking forward to Hosan. And then you see them on Tuesday, Hosan is our time off. You see them on Tuesday, so how did it go? Oh my God, I couldn't wait to get back on schedule because I didn't know what to do with myself. Now, it doesn't have to be. You know, you do learn eventually how to use your time. But it just points to there's my idea of what I should be feeling and what I should want and how I should enjoy myself. And there's the reality, what is actually happening. So those are the four nutriments. And, you know, and with consciousness, I should also say, you know, that we can't, you know, as I say, we can't throw away our stories. We also can't shut them down. You know, and this work that we've been doing around race and around gender, you know, I want to think, oh, I'm not affected by that. You know, I see the messages of what a woman should look like, should act like, that, but I'm not really affected by that. It's not really true. You know, I may have worked with it, you know, to not be affected in such a powerful way, but the fact is I'm hearing these messages all the time. Like what somebody gave the example, a woman, a mother, says to her daughter, you don't need to worry about your weight, you're beautiful the way you are. And the mother is constantly on a diet. What is that actually saying to the young girl? Right? And so this is, we're constantly communicating, feeding one another, and taking that in. And so all of these things shape our lives and shape our experience. And so Thich Nhat Hanh speaks of the importance of silence in order to know very consciously what it is that we're taking in. So I want to... Oh, Taiju, yes.
No, I just want to say, the last one that you were just talking about work, it's been such a big thing around retirement, and I have a lot of friends are retiring, yeah. And when I've retired, and when I had my knee surgery last year, I thought I was going to go crazy because there were different things I had lined up that I was going to do during this period of time when I had to go into this rehab. And my friends who are also at the same retirement point is when I said, oh, I'm going to go back, I want to figure out this way how I can get back to do some consulting and to work and to teach. And they keep saying, oh, you know, please, well, you don't have any time now anymore. You're not reachable. You're so busy working. And I'm saying, but I am so satisfied. I can't, it's just so hard because this concept about retirement is so, as long as I'm able to do it, I love what I'm doing. But there's such feedback from the rest of the world that, you know, you're not accessible, you're not doing this. you know, what's wrong with you, you know? It's sort of like, I'm enjoying it. But it's retirement is a different idea. First of all, you probably have prepared for it and have a lot of money to do it. I can do it with what I have, you know? Anyway, I just think retirement has been so mistakenly presented that you're not well if you're enjoying it by working.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I really try to, for myself, I more and more encourage myself to really examine these assumptions. You know, I had something similar to what Carolyn was describing earlier about, you know, I should enjoy going to the theater. You know, sometimes like with social gatherings. And I'm you could say I'm more of an introvert than not, but I actually do very much like social gatherings and like stimulating conversation and stuff. But I realized at a certain point there was so often that I was doing it because I really felt that I should. You know, I kind of felt that I had to. And at a certain point I realized, well, but who's telling me that? You know, why do I believe that that is how I should be? And I think part of it comes from coming from Mexico. You know, we tend to be very social beings and very family oriented, very, very friend oriented. I have several of my friends have kept in touch with each other for decades and decades. And part of me would really kind of want that. And part of me is like, but that's actually not, in fact, how I often am. I have some very good friends that I do, and I cultivate those friendships. But this thing of kind of, you know, just going out and going to parties and stuff, at a certain point I realized, but this doesn't fulfill me. But I had to really get over that hump, over that belief that I should be that person, you know?
I think accepting yourself is a piece of it. And when Carolyn was talking before about it, I really like just having this light classical music on all the time. It's in the background. So some people might perceive that as noise, but it really, with at the same time the interjections of what the real news is that's coming from tweeting and whatever, this provides a sort of a kind of a sanity for me. I love going out and I love doing social things, but sometimes I think being able to accept a duality of the things that I like, the other part being the fact that I like to go and spend a whole day doing something by myself, something that all the things that I want to do, that I don't have to, I love my lover, but it's kind of like I don't really want to have to check everything all the time. We want to do this most of the same things, but I really like this when I just go off and I get supported with doing that. So it sounds like you had a really great day. Yeah, and it wasn't necessarily with you. So I the duality of things, because it's just, I don't know, that's a duality that I find myself having to work with myself. But it's basically coming down to accepting myself. That's one of the biggest things, without judgment. You know, right. The judging thing really gets crazy.
And, you know, the fact that I had a really nice day without you doesn't mean anything about you. It means I had a really nice day by myself. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, we're so quick to take it personally. Oh, she doesn't want to be with me. Oh, da da da. It doesn't have to mean that. You know, you enjoy sometimes, you know, just staying at home and sitting in the fire. It doesn't mean anything other than that thing. It doesn't have to mean more than that. I mean, sometimes maybe it is that. Maybe you are avoiding something. But often it's much more simple than we often make it out to be. So I want to try something else, but let's first take a break, maybe a 10-minute break. So what I wanted to ask is if we could now spend a little bit of time, each of us reflecting, and I'll ask you to actually write this down so that you're really reflecting on this. You know, to write down, you know, a few, at least 3 to 5. If you have more, that's fine. Things that, those things that you feel are obstacles, you know, that really prevent you from practicing silence. And let me just finish the instruction, because you can stay here if you want, or if you want to go somewhere else in the building, you can do that. So we'll have a few minutes, you know, maybe 15 minutes or so. So really reflect, and you know, as you imagine, you kind of go run through a regular day, one of your regular days in your mind. Even if you're here, because there's those moments when, you know, when again silence is you're being asked to practice it. Are you really? And what are the ways that, again, you might not be, and what gets in the way, from small to large, you know? So the use of technology, my need, my desire to connect with someone else, you know, through speech, my fear, my anxiety, you know, whatever it is. So first is really, what are those things that prevent you or that make it more difficult for you to practice silence? And then if you can choose one of these and commit to really practicing it, you decide for how long, a week, a month, or from now on, you know, it's up to you. How will you do it? Right? So very, very concretely, for example, I will, for the next month, I will only check email once a day, or I will check email twice a week. Or I will only check email on Fridays, or I will be email free on Saturday, you know, whatever. But really make this doable, you know, be real about it. So that you're just as we do, you know, when we make a commitment for Ongo, that there is something that you're very deliberately turning your mind towards and saying, okay, I want, hopefully, you know, I want more to create, more of this space, more of this silence in my life. And so what concrete steps do I need in order to do that? Okay? So take a few minutes. Again, as I said, if you want to stay here in this room, you can. If you want to go somewhere in the building, that's fine. And in a little bit, I'll ring a bell if you're elsewhere to call you back. Okay. So to now give everyone an opportunity to speak, if you could just find a partner, and if you want, you can share with them what you wrote. If you feel like this, I want to keep this for myself, that's fine. And so then you would reflect with them. And so first, so you just speak and the other person listens. If you want to ask a question to clarify, you can do that, and then you switch sides. So you can either share some of what you wrote or reflect on, you know, in Zazen, as I have said now a couple of times, so the you could say, if you break it down, if you boil it down to its essentials, it is really seeing a thought, letting it go, and coming back to the focus of your attention. Let's say your breath. As you know, and some of you may just have done Zazen this morning or last night for the first time, but still, or if you've had years of experience, in those moments when you're finding it difficult to do that, to let go of a thought, to let go of a story, to just focus, to concentrate, what is in the way? So once again, what is preventing you from resting in that silence, in that stream, in that natural state of mind? So you understand? So you're sharing with your partner either what is kind of broader in your life, in the way, and what will you do to practice at least one of these things, and or in your Zazen specifically, what is getting in the way of letting go of a thought? So I'll ring the bell. So we'll do 5 minutes to find a partner, 5 minutes, and I'll ring the bell when it's time to switch and the other person speaks. Okay. Would anyone like to share what you've... And why don't you share yourself, not your partners? Oh. Well, let them say them if they wish.
I found that... In reflection, a lot of what prevents me from practicing silence is a lot of it is fear. Fear of various things that, you know, fear of what might come up in the stillness, fear of this, that, and the other. But the interesting thing that I found was I wrote down that for me there's a tension between needing to be in relationship to people and needing to be in community and things like that, needing to be with people, you know, talking to them, whatever. But at the same time, being an introvert and needing and valuing my privacy and my alone time as well. And that tension between those two needs or desires or whatever, trying to navigate that actually sometimes prevents me from really practicing and being in stillness and silence, because I'm thinking about, instead of, you know, being in the silence, I'm thinking about whether or not, like over Hosan, I should try to be with people, or whether, you know, my energy is at a point where I need to be alone, or, you know, so I'm thinking about that tension instead of just being.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody else? Yes, Stephen.
One of the things that came to me was being tired. You know, before Ongo started and I wasn't AM Chikido, I was no meditation master, but, you know, it was a lot easier to put in the mental effort to concentrate. And, you know, I mean, the last session was just like not trying not to fall asleep. You know, it wasn't even about concentrating. And I've noticed myself falling into like this complacency, you know. It's like I've gotten to the point where I'm like, well, if I can get through the day and like have energy during work, you know what I mean? And like, you know, like sometimes I feel like I'm just kind of crawling across the finish line, you know? And then other times it's like I have the energy, but I'm just like so relieved to have energy that I'm just going to be like, I'm just going to be lazy now and not use it. So that's been something that I've been working with, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just like being tired, and then also my like relationship to being tired too is like, you know, I have this propensity to daydream. So then there's the judging mind, and then I'm judging myself for judging myself, and it's like, you know, it's just brought so much up into my practice of like, it's just really tested my will and my ability to like, you know, my ability to really be willful, which is like, at least when it's like independently, when I'm doing any sort of practice, I can be pretty willful about things, and I can't really do that anymore. I can't like will myself awake. But I know, it's funny, because I've had moments where I can be awake, but it's not coming from a source of like this, sort of almost like ferocious will, you know, willpower.
Where is it coming from?
It's not surrendering, you know. It's not like, it's not just giving up. And it's not completely, it's not just accepting, you know. There is a sense of effort, but it's like this effort that's like, you know, it's like what you were talking about before. It's like a, like, it's like water, you know, it's like fluid. It's like, there's something, there's this weird switch that happens in me. And I notice it most when it happens during Zazen, because then I can actually stay awake for the full period. It's like, there's this weird stream, well of energy that flows, and I don't know. I'm like, I'm not in control of it, you know? I don't know. It's...
Well, chi, energy, life force, is in everything. And because the way our minds are built, we tend to perceive that key as either available to this body or not. Available to me, Suisei, to you, Stephen, and kind of finite, you know, that there's only so much of it to go around. I had that, in fact. I wrote exactly that. I'll find it, but it's the moment when we begin to really see that I don't actually begin and end here, that once again, for the time being, I have been loaned this physical body, and that it is what allows me, you know, to navigate my life, that there is the reality of this body and the reality of being tired, the reality of having this demanding service position, which is requires that you get up earlier, and therefore, you know, a very kind of real, observable circumstance. And then there is something else, kind of that stream that you're talking about that you're not in control of, and that is actually available to you from the people next to you sitting close to you in the zendo, that it is available. I would say it's actually available in physical objects also, but it's especially available in nature. You know, it's just, of course, like the force of the wind. Prana is wind, and it's also another name for that life force. But that really it is in things. And so if there's any aspect of you that trusts that stream and that trusts that you can't be in control, then let me suggest that you be open to the possibility that you can actually receive energy from everything and everyone throughout your day.
Yeah, you know, it's... you know, I go into the zendo every morning... you know, and it's like Shugen's there, and so is Raka-san.
Right.
And they're like, they're up before I am. I hear Raka-san leave, you know, at like 3 a.m. He lives right below me.
Right.
And I roll over in bed and I go back to bed for another 20 minutes, you know. And I'm like, and I like, sometimes I'm just like, how does he do, like, I say to myself, how does that old man do that? You know, like, but yeah, you know, and that's not a very receiving attitude. You know?
No, it isn't. So there, you can begin there, you know, begin to work there. And, you know, the example of Shugen Roshi that you gave is a good one. And I've had this conversation with him many, many times, you know, how to work, you know, with energy, my energy, life energy. And I also watch him, you know, I watch him practice. And I was saying to someone just the other day, you know, he spends his zazen time in the Dokusan room, mostly, yeah. Right? So he has currently about 300 students. And so there's an hour and a half in the morning, and on this current schedule, an hour and a half in the evening, and, you know, 30 residents to see, sometimes a little bit less. Plus people who are coming in, yourselves, you know, you're coming in from the outside, retreats, etc. So there's no other time. His zazen time, the only time he has to do zazen is if he gets up earlier. I mean, there's some that you can do in between people. But, you know, really uninterrupted time where he's really just being with himself and his mind, he doesn't have the way the rest of us do. And so what does he do? Because he knows that he needs it in order to keep giving to us. He gets up at an ungodly hour so that he can sit, so that he can recharge his mind. Now, he is able to do that. You know, I'm not suggesting that now you decide that you're not him and you don't need to be. And that's a conversation I've had with him many times. I have my path and my way of practice. You have yours. And so it's really finding, knowing that there are certain things that you need in order to keep going. How do you give them to yourself. And it is a pretty tight schedule, of course, as you know. The fact is you do have a demanding job that is requiring that you get up earlier than everybody else. Within that, do you realize that you're offering incense at each altar? Maybe you're just lighting a candle and just going like this and sticking the incense in. You're in front of a Buddha, four or five of them. They have a key. They have energy. And so start to cultivate a relationship with them. It's not just a wooden figure. And in that moment when you hear the alarm and Roxanne gets up and goes, even if you don't want to get up at that time, in that moment you hear it, you think, may he be filled with happiness and know the root of happiness, or may he fulfill his vows. Yeah. That's it. And see how that nurtures you, how that feeds you. Anybody else? Come on, you were so chatty just 5 minutes ago. Ikkyo.
I hate to ruin that great thing that you just said. So what I discovered as I was reflecting was that for me, silence, there's a tinge of deprivation to it. And yeah, so sometimes I it's funny, like being on here for the month, and I almost like feel a bit resentful some mornings that it goes on and on and on, or so it seems to me. And then when it goes off, I actually am like, what was I so cranky about? You know, it's like, not that talking is so, what was I after? And but then I realize it's because, or I think part of it is a sense of, you know, not having a voice that's ever been really listened to or considered important. And now this is getting taken away in this new way. So, yeah, but I guess I was never able to quite put a word to it, but I think deprivation is kind of a good one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess so what I thought about doing was, you know, how do I see my power in a way that doesn't need to include talking?
Mm. Mm. And I would say, you know, with the deprivation part of it, even go further. In the moment where you feel that arising, because I'm guessing that there's a feeling, and there's a thought associated with it, and you just said, and it's because this reason. And so even before the reason, can you really stay with that feeling? You know, we've talked a little bit about acceptance. You know, to allow a feeling that often we judge because we think, well, what is my problem? You know, why do I feel this way? Or I'm a practitioner, I shouldn't be feeling da-da-da-da-da. Let all of that go and really just stay with that feeling sense, that kind of physical experience of the deprivation, because it's going in there into it itself that will begin to shift it. You know, first is what begins to show you that it has no power, it has no solidity, but it has a truth in your life because that was the experience that you had all of these many years. And so I can say, well, you're not that person. Now it's a different time. You know, we can talk about that. You can talk yourself out of it. I'm suggesting that you really actually go into it, just as Anne was saying about letting that fill all of your awareness, going into that feeling itself and see what happens when you're in it, not talking to yourself about the feeling that you're having, but really in it. Besides what you're saying, you know, to continue to find ways to own and express your power in ways other than talking, but even more fundamentally than that, really allow, give permission for that deprivation, for that feeling to be there. Yes, Carolyn.
I'm a big worrier. If anybody wants me to worry for you, I can. And I find that...
I have a few things. Okay, well, can talk later.
I'm good. I'm good. I find that a lot of my worrying, and I know all the worrying in the world doesn't change anything. I've heard everything, you know, stop worrying, it's not going to do any good, but I worry. A lot of it turns into procrastination. Let's say I really need to clean the house, so I worry about it instead of doing it. And sometimes when I'm going to go sit, I think, well, before I sit, I really need to do this. I need to do this because I'll sit and I'm going to worry that I haven't done what I'm worrying about. So if I go and I do the things I'm worrying about, I end up not sitting. It's a real awful thing. So when we were talking about, well, what are you going to try to do? I think the best thing I can do is quit procrastinating. You know, I really need to get away from that. And I have time to do everything. I just don't do it. And it turns into a worry thing. So
how do you think you can do that differently?
It's a tough question. I keep, when I'm really worried about something, I go, it's not doing any good up here worrying about it because it's not going to change any outcome. It's not going to make things any different. So it's really hard to stop worrying.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I don't know.
So I wonder what function worrying is serving, actually serving, because as you yourself said, it's not helping you to get those things done.
It's not serving any function, I don't think, unless I get something done.
I don't think you're crazy.
Oh, thank you.
Right? Or irrational. It's serving some function. And the question is what? So I would turn to that. Look at that. So when you're sitting there worrying, you've already gone through the logic in your mind. You already know this isn't helping, da-da-da. But there's some part of you that still feels the need to do it, clearly. So I would go there, like, and really ask it, you know, what is happening? What I said, basically, what is the function of this worry right now? Because something is happening. Let that tell you. Yes, Anne.
I want to say something because I'm also, I have been in a couple of car accidents in the past year, and it's uncovered a wellspring of anxiety, some of it going very deep into my past. And so I, you know, am avoiding things. And while I have had a bit of success dealing with physical discomforts and itches and things like that, this anxiety is very different. And this trying to get to the center of it is actually making it harder for me.
Yeah.
And so my very empathetic listener suggested trying to work around the edges of it. And mm-hmm. I don't know what that will look like. You know, in fact, my initial reaction was, gee, can I do that? But I think that's actually going to prove helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, there are definitely things like that. I remember speaking to a young man who was in residence, who was in pretty severe pain, for whom the suggestion, you know, the instruction to go into the pain actually made it worse. It was not actually helping him. And so he found a way, in a sense, to do what Chris offered to you, there's a technique, you could say, in this kind of therapy, it is called titrating, where you find a point in your body that is grounded. So the way that I'm sitting, I can feel the mat on the tip of my big toe. So that I'll choose that as my anchor. And from there, if there's a strong emotion that I'm having, anchored on the ground, anchored with my foot on the ground, I will go towards it. And it's called titrating because you go in a little bit, and then when it becomes too strong and the anxiety just gets worse, you step back and you anchor yourself again. And you do that, you know, if you need 5 minutes, it's fine. You know, you can do it for however long. You're training yourself to slowly be able to get closer to it, so you can see really what it is. But you're not doing it full on. And so there's other ways in which you can kind of get to it from another direction. But I feel really that so much of practice is increasing our emotional resilience. Because sometimes in the silence and in the stillness, it is very difficult to feel what we feel. You know, some of us have sometimes for years just push things aside or learn to maneuver around them. And in Zazen, if you do it for long enough, at some point things do begin to bubble up. And some, especially something like you're describing, you know, really the trauma of having an accident, and not just and more than once. You know, the body stores that experience, and so you need to get through it. It's kind of what I was saying to Ikkyo. You need to get through it through the body, not just the mind. And there's things you can do with your mind that will help. But at a certain point, you have to get to the stored memory, the physical memory itself, and you can't rush that process. You wouldn't want to, because the body has its wisdom. I mean, the reason we build all of our defenses is, again, not because we're crazy, but because we know that is what will protect us and keep us going. So I've developed great respect for my patterns. You know, I tended to have very kind of obsessive thinking. And sometimes I would be sitting there in Zazen, like with a phrase, just repeating it over and over, not in a mantra kind of way, but just like in an obsessive kind of way. And at a certain point, it hit me. It kind of regulates me, you know? So when I was feeling agitated or I was feeling something and I wasn't sure what I was feeling, this kind of repetition just quieted me enough for things to begin to settle, and then for me then to start to see, oh, this is what is actually happening. And at a certain point, I started to actually use that. I like repetitive. I use mantras in my practice. I like repetitive activities. You know, I love running, swimming. You know, things that facilitate that quieting and that grounding of my being. But I didn't know that I was doing that. I just did it kind of naturally, and then I saw I could actually use this. I'm not. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm not crazy. This has its own wisdom. And therefore, I can use it. Yes, Maria Jose.
One of the things that came up first was this almost compulsion to be busy at work. And I work all the time. And my work requires communicating. I'm a translator, copy editor, so I'm always engaging work with or through language or communicating with clients about the work. So there's constant talking or using language, even if it's in my own mind. And so I very much need silence, you know, to disengage from work, but I don't do it. I'm always... you know, Friday afternoon, because there might be a client on the West Coast who sends me a request for Monday, and I can't say no because I'm going to be poor and destitute if I don't take it, which is not true, of course. And so there's this constant need to be working all the time, and I don't set a schedule for myself. And that has its advantages. You know, on a day like today, I might go climbing in the middle of the day instead of working and then work late. So, you know, there are good reasons for this, but I don't leave enough time to rest my mind from, you know, writing or rewriting. Even my own work, my own creative work, is poetry for the most part. And so I'm always engaged in with words, and I don't know how to set that aside. And I find that when I'm done with work, I don't want to read a book, I don't want to watch a movie and process language,
And so I just work all the time until I have to go to sleep. Mm. And that's not good. So I need to figure out how to find some space. And this has been a pattern for about, I don't know, over a decade now. And then I crash.
Because no one can sustain that, no matter how.
It's very draining.
What great capacity you have, at a certain point, you have to rest. At a certain point, your body just says, okay, we're shutting down now.
Yeah. Well, my body can keep going. It's my brain. I'm juicing it all the time. But I couldn't come up with anything concrete. Whereas, like, my social media thing is very easy. It's like, okay, well, I won't do this thing that often, or, you know, I'll turn off my notifications on my phone after dinner and until, you know, mid-morning or whatever. But for this, I feel like there's a fear of, you know, because I live alone, my parents, I actually give my parents money. They don't, you know, nobody can support me if I need, you know, help. So there's this compulsion to always take on all the work that comes to me, because otherwise, you know, I'm not going to be able to pay rent. And none of that is true.
So, what I'm hearing is that some of the fear, I mean, there's a practical consideration. You do need to make money. You need to make a living. But some of what that fear that you're expressing is not actually based on facts, right? You don't need to work all the time.
No, my rent is actually going down next month. It's like nobody, that never happens.
So if you do nothing, you will continue as you are, most likely, because it's a pattern that you've established, and although it gives you some amount of pain, not enough to shift it. Is that fair?
Yes, it's not enough to shift it, and I actually get a lot of satisfaction from being good at what I do and being so productive. But I could take it down a notch or two and still feel very proud of my work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because so a pattern like that, if you have capacity, if you have great capacity, and it sounds like you do, you could just continue doing that for a good long while. You know, you're still young, and you could just do that. And wait until you really crash. That's one way to shift. You know, I often think that we don't change until we absolutely have to, because change is so challenging, so difficult, and it requires a shift in our way of being. And you know, we so often don't want to do that. Even when we say that we want to, we don't really want to. And so one way would be to just wait until you can no longer do this. Another way would be to ask yourself, what is it, you know, when we're talking about volition, what is it that you actually most want? In other words, what's the kind of life that you want to live? Let's say that hopefully you'll be fortunate enough to be able to look back at your life, right, that you won't just, you know, have a heart attack and drop dead, but hopefully you'll have time to actually take stock of your life. Is there anything about the the way that you're doing things now that will give you regret, that will be a source of regret, either because you're not able to do certain things or because there are certain things you're doing in a way that you really wish you didn't. You know, this sense of urgency that is very much present and you could say cultivated in Buddhism and certainly in Zen practice is not meant to make us more anxious. It is meant to remind us there really is not a lot of time. Time does swiftly pass by. An opportunity is lost. We lose the opportunity. Let's take it out of the passive voice. We lose opportunity. And so, you know, remembering, you know, the Buddha said, you know, the five reminders or remembrances are that we are of the nature to grow old. We're of the nature to become sick. We are of the nature to die. Right? No matter who we are, how much we have, what we do with our lives, some of us may not get sick, but we will all get old. Some of us will get old. We will all die. Everything that I have, that I own, all of my relationships, all of my possessions, I will lose. The only thing that I have are my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. that is, in a sense, you could say, for me, my beacon. Because on my deathbed, that will actually be the only thing that I have, what I have done. And not as in, what have I achieved, but what kind of actions, basically what kind of karma have I created. And I have always found that an incredibly compelling reminder to keep me on what is most important. And I actually often do phrase it to myself in that way. It's like, what will I regret not doing? Especially not doing. If I was to die now, or somebody said to me, you have a year to live, what do I really want to do? What kind of person do I want to be before that happens? And so, I don't remember who it was. It was a teacher who's is a healthy recognition that death is always riding on one shoulder. Life is on the other one. So again, it's not morbid or frightening. It is realistic in saying, okay, this is the time that I've been given. This is the time that I have. How will I use it? And then don't wait, because if you know the things that you want to change, don't wait. Start in the beginning. It probably will be awkward. You'll fall back and you'll do things the way you've always done. But that's why it's called practice. You turn to it over and over again. Jacob Bohm, the German mystic, said, "When you move silently, then you are that which was before nature and creature, and out of which was created your nature and creature." Right? So you are that which was before you were Maria Jose. You were that. That thing, that it, that becomes evident when you move silently. And out of that very thing, out of that very source, you were created. You are that very thing. And so, you know, as I was saying earlier, we speak of being silent as a kind of an active endeavor. I will refrain from speaking. I will practice silence. But this is really saying, well, no, I will just be that silence. I will return to that silence because it is, in fact, my being, because I was never apart from it. You know, and Merton says how we have, by losing our capacity to be silent, we are losing very much our sense of peace and of joy. And he says, you know, not all of us are called to be hermits, and I don't think it's necessary even, but it's just having enough silence to be able to hear that inner voice, at least some of the time. Because when we don't, and he speaks of it in very similar terms, he says, we're no longer moved from within, but only from outside ourselves. So he says, "For we cannot go on happily for long unless we're in contact with the springs of spiritual life which are hidden in the depths of our soul." And they're actually not hidden. They're actually very evident. It's just that we cover them up. Sometimes because what it will mean, you know, as Liam was saying, you know, the fear of what will come up. Sometimes we know very well what will come up, and we're not ready to hear it. So we cover it up. Okay, that's fine. But if we continue to practice some form of silence, it will keep coming up, right, as I said before. And he says also, if we're constantly exiled from our own home, locked out of our own spiritual solitude, we cease to be true persons. It's interesting because the true person is a Zen term. And he studied some Zen, so he may have gotten it from that. And then that's when he says we're no longer moved from within, but only from outside ourselves. So really you could say that all of this practice and all of this effort and all of this doing and trying not to do, to just be, is really so that we can be a true person. We can be a true person with ourselves and with others. And I was reading, there's a writer who just did a study on silence and its lack, and how they did a study. I guess they somehow were able to well, they probably, they had recordings and they just grafted, you know, that Hitler's voice, you know, the decibels, he consistently, when he was really getting, trying to get people riled up, he would be consistently at a higher decibel than is normal. And that the effect that this had on people was agitating. It was agitating. But it wasn't just that, because he knew very well how to modulate his voice, so he would return to kind of a very melodic, kind of lower register, and then from that come back again. So he actually knew, I don't know, probably consciously, how to use his voice to give rise to a state of mind, a state of being in large groups of people. One person. And so if that is the power that we have, you know, so I, at the beginning of the day, I spoke of Dharani and you spoke of liturgy. So, and we're immersed in it, you know, the residents especially, we're immersed in it. We're doing this all the time. Understand that these sounds have enormous power, just as the silence that surrounds them has enormous power. And it's just that so often we're just not, we're not paying attention to it. But so that's why it's possible for things to really contain that key. And, you know, one of the things that I had thought of, but we don't have enough time, but just to offer it to you, you know, in terms of either Zazen or as you're moving about your life, going about it, to find... in this case, a sound or a collection of sounds, whether it's a phrase that you, in English, you know, that you understand, or whether it's something like a short Dharani or a short mantra, something that becomes your anchor, right? There's so many religious traditions in which the use of mantras is to collect the mind, to anchor the mind, to ground the mind. And again, we don't often speak about them in Zen, but they are used. They are used in Zen. And I have used mantras throughout my practice exactly for that, well, for many purposes, but one of them is exactly for that, to be able to return to that ground, to ground myself. And the most powerful ones I find are the ones that you yourself create, that you come up with, whether they're existing already, but that they're the ones that you're recognizing, you have resonance with that particular sound or that particular phrase or that particular word, right? So it doesn't even have to. In fact, the simpler it is, the more likely you are to remember it. So to return to that and let that be your anchor. The breath can be an anchor, but sometimes it's subtle. Sometimes you need a little more zhuzh. And so I wanted also just to mention, so in terms of Zazen, so some of you were speaking, you know, really about that obstacle to being in silence and practicing silence in your life. And in Zazen, you know, the Buddha spoke of different ways to work with your mind, with thoughts. And so I wanted to just go back in full circle, because I posed the question earlier about, you know, is it really about stopping thoughts or is it not? And so here he's just, thoughts are arising as they do, and how do you work with them? And he said, so first you have thoughts that are unwholesome, and by this it doesn't, let's just say any thought that is preventing you from doing what you want to do in that moment. So whether it's just a very distracting thought, or is you are actually having a thought that is, you're wishing ill will towards someone else, it is in some way harmful. If that is arising, then shift. You abandon that thought and you give rise to a thought that is wholesome. Right, so in a moment of you're angry and you're saying to someone, oh, you know, I really, in your mind, you're thinking, I really hate their guts. In that moment, drop, abandon that thought and shift. May you be happy. May you be filled with happiness and know the root of happiness. Right, so he's saying just shift. Now, you can't do that. It's just strong enough, it persists, you're not able to do that. If you can't, then examine the danger in such a thought. And the example he gives here is actually quite graphic. He says, imagine that you have a corpse hanging around your neck. And simply just to alert you to the danger, to the harm of such a thought. So in other words, and this is a time where you would kind of, you talk to yourself, you say to yourself, this is not helping me. This angry thought, not only is it hurting the other person, it's actually hurting me, right? So I will remind myself that this is not actually how I want to live my life. If you can't do that, then he says, try to forget them. Try to forget such a thought, which is really kind of what we say, let it go. You know, set it aside and just don't feed it with your awareness. Right? So he's saying, first you replace it with a wholesome thought. If you can't do that, examine the danger of those thoughts. If you can't do that, if it continues, forget it. Don't feed it with your attention. If you can't do that, and he says, give attention to stilling the thought formation. And this is a little bit of a technical phrase, but basically is saying, in that impulse to move, whether to move with the mind or to move away, you know, with your body, still that thought formation. Another way I would say that is find that quiet source. And no one can tell you how to do that. You have to find how to do that. So that's why it's, you know, it's a little further along. Still the thought formation. And then he says, if none of this works, crush the mind with mind. And this one is, again, is tricky because that seems like, oh, that's such a macho thing, it's a Zen thing. But this is the Buddha speaking, and it is a last resort. None of it worked. None of it you were not able, you know, to maintain, you know, that stillness and that silence. Okay, then it's basically kind of like saying, enough. I will not continue this harmful pattern. In a moment of true anger, is if you can have any clarity, is basically saying, cut off. And he's not saying do that every time a thought arises, because then the danger is just that you suppress. It is really, when nothing else worked, it is kind of saying, no, I will not go there anymore. Right? And so crushing mind with mind is a strong image, but sometimes that is what is required. Is I will no longer, it's like the Buddha saying to Mara, I know you, I will not bow to you, because I know who you are. And then, let me just close with this. A number of years ago, I was in Savannah, Georgia. I was with my brother was going to school there, and I would go for a run every morning. He would be gone for the day, and I would sit first, and then I would go for a run. And so it was a very nice progression, because I could move from that stillness into movement, and from, you could say, kind of more silence into activity. But I was still by myself, and I was running. And so one day I would go for these long runs, and one day I was going for a run, and I passed underneath what I found out was a convent, and it had a passageway, kind of like those they have at the airport, that they're those glass corridors to go from one building to the other. And they had one of those, so there were two buildings, and the corridor went right over the street. And standing right flush in the middle of the corridor, about a foot from the glass, was a nun in full habit. And at first I couldn't tell from a distance, maybe it was black, maybe it was dark brown, and her hands were in her sleeves, and I think she was veiled, and she was just standing, unmoving. And I saw her, and it was very striking, very powerful, and very compelling, in fact, and so I slowed down. And I slow down a little more, and I slow down, and then I stopped, probably maybe 20 feet from the walkway. And she must have seen me, She very quietly turned and walked away. And as she did, as she disappeared from view, I actually felt as if she had taken that space with her. It wasn't just that she was no longer there. It was like there was an absence that got kind of sucked out of that spot. It was very striking. I will never forget it. And so, you know, when I came home, you know, later that night, I told my brother, and he said, oh, yes, you know, they're always there. It's a, I believe they were Carmelites. And he said, there's always a nun there. He was a photographer. He said, I've tried to stop, photograph her. Whenever they see you, she just walks away. And he says, but I don't even know when they do kind of like the changing of the guard, if you will. He says, because there's always someone there. It can't possibly be the same person. And yet I've never seen them trade places. I mean, maybe they do it in the middle of the night or something. And I was so moved and struck by that. And I remember thinking to myself, and I was in college at the time, and I remember experiencing her stillness and her silence as a clarion call for me. It was also the time in my life. It's as if she was saying to me, look at what you're doing. What's all this bustle? You know, you're hurrying from here to there. You're doing all these things. What for? Do you even know? Of course, she said none of these things, but that's really how I felt. It was an experience that really changed me. And I hadn't come here. I had started sitting on my own, but I hadn't come here yet. That came soon after. And so I have thought for quite some time, you know, that I very much experience silence with stillness, especially because of my practice of Zazen. But I have thought for quite a while now that they're the two of the most powerful tools that we have as human beings, that our ability to hold ourselves and hold the world, hold reality, and be witness to it, you know, face it. Our ability to not react so consistently, so often so negatively, as Neruda was saying at the beginning, this constant misunderstanding of one another, this constant fighting and threatening each other with death, that our ability to not do that and to hold that in that space of silence is one of the most powerful things that we have to offer one another. Not because silence will take care of everything, because of course it will not, but because it will give us the ability to proceed more clearly, hopefully more kindly, so that we can in fact be of benefit to everyone. Yeah, I think that's good. So may the merits of this practice benefit all beings. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.